good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. We only have a couple minutes here at the top of the show, and I wanted to get to a kind of a segue from last night. Dr. Spence was with us, and we didn't get a chance to discuss the Russians, according to a Washington Post story, actually hacking into the Democratic National Committee server and doing due diligence on not only Donald Trump, but also Hillary Clinton. And in Forbes today, a companion piece was written, and if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and you click on the Radio with Pictures, that will take you to our links tonight. That first link, which is about the DNC server, has some very provocative, interesting implications. Richard, are you with us? Hello? Richard, are you there? Oh, I guess our connections are not working. I'm told stand by. Okay, we will stand by. This is so interesting because I have maintained that the reason this whole server thing is important has nothing to do with a penchant for secrecy. It's much more interesting. Richard, are you there? I'm not hearing Richard in my ear. Okay, so I'm told to stand by. So the thing that's so intriguing is that if you assume the Russians, with their vast capabilities, and apparently there were two break-ins, something called Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, two separate agencies. Richard, are you there? Hello?
Hello.
Now I can hear you.
I'm here.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, sorry about the technical screw-ups at the top of the show. Technology always is letting us down when we need it most. So have you had a chance to kind of think about this Russian penetration of the DNC and the implications for them doing it to Hillary and having read all 33,000 of her so-called private emails?
Well, I went back and looked at the Washington Post article that seems to be one of the first places this appeared. And one of the things I noticed, it's an article by Ellen Nakashima, and there's an interesting paragraph in here. The intrusion into the DNC was one of several targeting American political organizations. The networks of presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were also targeted by Russian spies, as were the computers of some Republican political action committees. So they already have, apparently. I mean, this is part of a larger picture here. There are a couple of things about it. Go ahead. You may have a comment here.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say the Forbes piece basically says what the Post does not address at all is if they have this capability to simply overwhelm the DNC security,
why
do we think that Hillary had any better security and they didn't read all 33,000 of the emails she ostensibly destroyed?
Oh, they probably did. In fact, you can count on it.
So knowing Putin, or knowing the Russian background of Putin, is he going to use this to intrude deliberately into the American political campaign?
Well, okay, I got to throw a monkey wrench into this, just for the one thing I see in this and other articles is the assertion that the Russians are behind this, but I see no actual evidence that they are.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things I'd be cautious of is, remember last night we were talking about the Orlando attack, and you brought up the point that in the reporting of it, there was the emphasis upon gay bar as opposed to bar. And you
yes.
asked a very important question. Well, why constantly cite gay bar? And I think you got to the point of it, because gay bar in a headline makes better copy than bar.
Hmm.
And what has happened here is that the DNC has been hacked. Apparently, Hillary and the Donald's campaigns have been hacked, and her server has been hacked. And, you know, when you can say hacker, it is going to sound sexier if you can put Russian hacker on.
Russian hacker, of course.
So, I don't dismiss the possibility at all, but it doesn't have to be them. And in looking through this, I don't see that anybody has established it is. I mean,
hold
like you know something if you can say the Russians did it.
Exactly. Okay, hold it there. I'm going to pick this up after our break, 3 minutes. We're taking a short commercial break. You're on the other side of midnight. Richard Spence will return to close this out. And then we'll get to my second guest of the evening, and we're going to talk about what does this really all mean against the backdrop of, are we in some kind of sim? Amazing times we're living in. You're on the other side of midnight, where we talk about the things that go bump in the night, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. Richard, I had thought that I had read in the piece that they had identified two separate Russian intelligence agencies. That's why they gave them these cute code names, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear.
Well, the way that I read it, which maybe I missed something in it, is that Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear were the names that the tech company, a sort of counter-hacker company that the DNC brought in, gave to what they deduced were two different groups of hackers.
Yeah, but the reason they called them bears is because they thought they were Russians, the Russian bear.
Because they thought they were Russian, or that they suspected they're Russian. And my point here isn't to try to defend the honor of the Russian intelligence services, so I think they're quite capable. They're entirely capable of doing it, but the point is that if you look at what's actually there, no one has presented any proof that it is.
Okay,
by the easiest assumption, and they're calling them the bear, it could be anything.
Let's assume it's not the Russians then, it's someone else, right? The bottom line is the same, because that capability could have penetrated her so-called private server, and somebody... Not us, not her, ostensibly, not the Russians, have all those emails. And to me, that's the reason she's not going to be the candidate. I don't know how we're going to get from here to there, but I've been saying now for months she's not going to be the candidate. And I think this now proves that those emails are somewhere on the loose out there, and they're going to come back and bite her at exactly the wrong time.
It is entirely possible. The question is, who has them and what are they going to do with them? You know who would be the person who would be most interested to know, just in this case, what the DNC had in terms of Trump research? The Trump campaign. Not the Russians. The people who have the greatest interest in knowing
what a great idea.
Would be the opposite campaign. And which isn't to prove that they did it either. But if I was going to look around and argue who is perfectly capable of hiring the hackers to do this, remember, Trump has plenty of money to do it. There are people available with that capability, who can do this both inside and outside of intelligence agencies. And to me, they would be the ones who would have the greatest interest or motive in getting a hold of that material. The same way, if the Trump campaign has been hacked, that's because there are people in the Clinton camp who want it. There's nothing
Some pundit this afternoon said that because of this interesting relationship between, Trump and Putin said overwhelmingly fulsome things, and everybody understands when I use the word fulsome, it's in the real meaning, not everybody what everybody thinks. Fulsome praise is false praise, everybody. Yeah. And a lot of people, even people who should know better, they always get that wrong. So Putin comes out with this fulsome praise for the ego of Donald Trump. Donald swallows it hook, line, and Putin. And then suddenly we find the Russians ostensibly are picking the DNC's brains about background on Donald Trump. Don't we think that maybe Putin already knows all this stuff on Trump?
He probably does. He has a good reason to know it, but it could be through this hack, or it could be through the...
From years backward, any prominent billionaire in the American capitalistic aristocracy, oligarchy, is going to obviously have a dossier on everything he's doing in case they need it.
Well, think of it this way. From the American side, when Putin was rising, and when Yeltsin had appointed him his stand-in president, and then when he was elected, don't you suppose that inside the U.S. government there were agencies trying to scramble to get together every scrap of information, public and private, that they could find about him because you want to know the people who are governing these countries?
Of course. Absolutely.
That's their job. And the Russians are going to do the same thing. That's their job, is to collect information. But there's another interesting thing to keep in mind about a hack is a kind of high-tech version of what used to be called a black bag job.
Oh.
A black bag job is really just a break-in. The Watergate was a kind of classic
plumbers, yes.
Right, a black bag job. But if you do it right, if country A is going to hack information from country B, if you do it right, you make it look like it was done by country C or D or E.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you would leave breadcrumbs, which would lead them in another direction. So if you actually, the thing that I would be suspicious of is if you were looking through here, and with all of the sophistication these people have seen, or whatever they're shown, and then if there appear to be these clues pointing towards the Russians, well, it could be. Maybe they got sloppy, or maybe those clues are there deliberately.
Very deliberate fingerprints.
Right. They got hacked. That's the only thing that we know. Mm. And who did it, you're never really going to know. And the Russians make good copy. That's it.
Yep. Well, I tend to agree that we need to keep all options open. But the MacGuffin, I think, at the end of this trail is what's on those so-called private emails. Mm-hmm. And you know my theory that all of her UFO conversations and maybe even information, a la John Podesta, was kept on those private servers in anticipation of needing them now as part of the larger ritual and the larger plan. And if someone did hack into that server and those are now bouncing around loose out somewhere on the planet, who knows where this could go?
Let's wait and see if they show up on WikiLeaks.
Well, thank you, Richard. I want to close
out
last night.
All right.
Thanks much. Our next guest, and this may sound to some like we're kind of switching topics, but actually we're not. Because given how fluid things are, given how you can't believe in the evening what you've read in the morning, it seemed to me that if we brought Cynthia back and finally had her talk about some of the things that we just began in one of our earlier conversations for our new audience at our new home, it would be very appropriate. And believe me, when we're talking in the same breath about Donald Trump running for president and the Russians hacking into, you know, the Secretary of State's private server to find secret emails on the fact that the human race may not be alone, again, scenario, have we not crossed into some kind of twilight zone? Cynthia Sue Larson, intuitive life coach, best-selling author, and radio show host, had a sense from early childhood of remembering she was before she was born, like who she might be, with a feeling of being connected to the presence of loved ones who were ever present, compassionate, and in harmonious alignment with themselves and others. The disparity between what she remembered from before she was born and the way most Westerners tend to think, feel, and act initially led her to lead an inner spiritual life and later begin to share her insights and observations with clients as a spiritual and intuitive life coach. Cynthia began writing her Reality Shifters website and monthly enzine in October of 1999 with the purpose of sharing first-hand experiences of and scientific information about reality shifts with people around the world. She defines reality shifts as being, quote, the manifestation of objects appearing, disappearing, transforming and transporting, changes in the way we experience time, any sudden abrupt alteration of physical reality with no apparent physical cause, and the source of synchronicity. Cynthia experienced many instances of things appearing, disappearing, transforming, and transporting, and found that most people she mentioned reality shifts to had their own amazing reality shift stories to tell. In April of 2000, Cynthia conducted the first ever online survey, I'll get this right someday, of reality shifts, a.k.a. glitches in the matrix, quantum jumping, mind-matter interactions, and she was trying to determine which types of reality shifts are most commonly observed and how people feel when encountering these experiences. She conducted a follow-up survey in 2013 that included a question about seeing dead people or animals alive again, a.k.a. the Mandela Effect, with 27% of respondents indicating they had witnessed this or some type of reality shift. So good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. Such a pleasure to be on the show.
And which Cynthia am I talking to this morning? I couldn't wait to get that in. Okay. We only could kind of skim the surface, and I must say your last appearance in talking about this evoked such email and such interesting reaction from a lot of people that kind of had a background, and they, as I said on that show, we tend to hurry on of things that we don't really understand, kind of ignoring them, assuming they'll just kind of fade back into the background of stuff that we do understand. And this is not fading. This is becoming more interesting. I'm getting more emails, including from some people that you would not believe have told me personal stories of things showing up in this reality that they did not remember from another what?
Right. Yes, this is definitely a phenomenon that doesn't go away. And the more you pay attention to it, the more you start seeing of it. So I think there's a big reason for this surge in interest, because you're right. It's just in the last year, this has been really picking up and become riveting for people that had never heard of such a thing before.
If you can get just a little closer to that mic, because I'm getting more low frequencies than high frequencies, and you have
Thank you.
Many nice high frequencies. I want to get the high frequencies in there. Okay, so where should we begin? I guess probably for people like me, the last time we talked, I had no idea this phenomenon existed other than the lives of me and Robin. I mean, it's not something that you kind of go out and talk to people about unless they're really close, because they may think you're a little, you know, missing a couple of cards.
Right. And this is one of the reasons that for many years, people who have these experiences don't tend to talk about them, because there's often the assumption that you might be somehow mistaken. And like you said, you want to just rush on, get on with the rest of your life. Often people don't know where to put this sort of thing in their own personal X-files as to what just happened here.
Interesting. So, okay, if we go to othersideofmidnight.com, the other side of midnight, and we click on your page, and we go up under Cynthia's items, there's item number one, which is the earliest examples of the Mandela effect. So if we click on that.
Yes. I need to refresh my page because it looks like my first item is actually.
Yeah, this is a video of you.
Oh,
right?
Good, yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's okay. So I can set this up. This video I just posted a month ago. And to give you some idea of the popularity of this concept, it's now received more than 20,000 views in just a few weeks. So that's pretty strong interest for something that I wasn't treating any differently than my other videos that at this point would usually maybe have 1 or 2, maybe 3,000 views. But 20,000 in just a month is pretty strong. Mm. And so this particular video, if you haven't seen it yet, has to do with the entire coverage of the so-called Mandela effect, explaining what that is for people that have never heard of it. The Mandela effect is a term that was coined by a blogger, Fiona Broom. And this was back in 2010. And basically, the idea that she had presented was that a lot of people were noticing that Mandela had died in prison many, many years earlier, but somehow he was alive at that time in 2010. Hmm. Now, of course, now he's passed away. So some people noticed when he died a second time, like, wait a minute, that's kind of strange. But even before he died the second time, some people remembered very clearly that he had passed away previously. So I was presenting a little bit of a summary of that, and then the figure that you cited earlier, that when I did a survey recently for the question of having seen dead people and animals alive again, 27% of the almost 600 respondents reported yes, they had seen that.
Hmm, that's a huge number.
It is actually huge, and I'd been tracking this phenomenon.
And that's a third of everybody you talk to.
That's right. And when this tells you that there's really something big going on, but oftentimes people, they tend to think that it's one of those mistaken ideas. We hear that quote, "The report of my death was an exaggeration." And you might remember having heard that. That was a quote by Mark Twain. And he had been writing to his friend Frank Marshall White at the time. And so we tend to assume, like, okay, you know, that's funny. You know, people just got carried away, or maybe news stories get mixed up. But what I'm suggesting in this video, and also through my research, is that actually this could be happening. You know, people that are just on the periphery, usually it's not someone you spend time with every day, because you'd notice if they died. And then you know, and then it's so emotional, the impact is huge. So it's harder for them to then subsequently become alive again without some huge disruption in your life. But if they're far enough in the peripheral vision of the focus of your life, then it's not outside the realm of possibility in a quantum multiverse that it seems that we're in.
Well, I guess we have to kind of go there right now, which is, in your model, how is this explained? Because once we have a kind of a foundation for how this might be possible, then we can talk about kind of paradoxes that make that model maybe not as attractive as some other model. And so let's start
sure.
with, what do you think is going on?
Well, I've been looking at this phenomenon of reality shifts since 1999, so that's 17 years now. And my background is in physics. I do have a degree from UC Berkeley in physics. So the first place I go to is, okay, I know for sure people are appearing, disappearing, transforming, becoming alive again, that kind of thing. So how could we explain all these different phenomena? And what I noticed early on is that these very aberrant types of strange phenomena that we see in our everyday lives are not considered so strange in the realm of the very, very small. So for quantum phenomena, quantum particles do teleport. They do exist in a superposition of states. Uh-huh. And so my theory is, it's not really my theory, but some physicists that I think are on the right track are suggesting that the many worlds of quantum physics are one and the same as the multiverse. In other words, this idea of many possible realities that we tend to expect is definitely happening at the quantum level.
So let me get this straight. In the classic quantum, I mean, that's like I'm mixing two terms. In the quantum physics explanation of the universe, of reality, starting at the very tiny, the subatomic world, the theory is that every time there's a quantum transition, every time a particle changes an energy state, every time, you know, a photon of light is emitted, that kind of thing, the universe, in essence, has made a decision, and there is a multiplication of our entire universe to accompany that separate reality. Is that the model here?
You're on the right track, and then all of the discussion subsequently becomes who made that decision, and there's a lot of controversy right there. So the idea of consciousness, you know, is nature making the decision, or is one of us? And then who are we? What is consciousness? We don't have a really definitive definition for it that everybody agrees on. We also don't have a way to scientifically measure it and validate it. So the thing that we're
let me stop you there. What's the widest accepted definition? I mean, the one that I would go with is consciousness is that quality exemplifying self-awareness.
That's a good start. But then sometimes people notice that there's a way to pay attention without being aware. And they're all different. It's like this huge decision tree between awareness and attention.
Are we talking like advanced esoteric meditation techniques, stuff like that?
No, we're just talking cognitive science.
Okay.
People who are actually studying neurons in the brain and so forth, and looking at laboratory animals and determining what they're paying attention to, what they're aware of. And so there can be background things that we're aware of, not consciously, but subconsciously. And there's a huge disparity of different types of effects that occur in an organism, in a biological organism. So we have people trying to track down consciousness and find it in the neurons. I'm not really of that school. I don't think we're going to find consciousness in the neurons. And then we've got people, like you say, the meditators and the yogis who've been studying this for thousands of years, and they would suggest that consciousness is primary, that it's fundamental. I think they're on the right track. And I would add to that that it seems clear that the principles and the whole concept of quantum physics, the logic behind it and the phenomena that occur in quantum physics, I believe that's fundamental to all of nature, and that we are much more quantum than most people realize.
Hmm. So the idea of Bose-Einstein condensates, which is when two subatomic particles share the exact same everything, so they're basically one particle, even if they're at opposite ends of the universe, experiments seem to prove that they can communicate with each other faster than light, instantaneously, whatever that means, and that you can't send meaningful information faster than light for reasons I've never quite understood, and maybe I'm just not digging deep enough into it. But are we at that level of reality where if the universe really multiplies, which of course begs the question, where does all that mass come from instantly when you make one little quantum decision? Or is mass an illusion? Is it all some incredible, as Elon Musk has said, complicated simulation?
Right. And to someone like Elon Musk, I have so much respect for what he's doing with the OpenAI project and so many other projects. I would say he's probably looking at it very much like an information theorist that he is. And I think that's actually not a bad way to look at it. But then those of us who believe that humans have free choice and that spirituality is real and consciousness should never be reduced to something that you could just say in a mathematical equation, there's definitely something else going on. And that's what I mean. So consciousness itself, that's what I meant by there's no real definition. And when we agree that we are conscious and obviously we're not reducible to some equation or mathematical formula or something like that.
Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning, Cynthia Sue Larson, and we're talking about, something kind of trivial. What's reality? And we'll talk about it in a few minutes when we return. And we are back on the other side of midnight at the bottom of the hour. It's 70 degrees here in the Land of Enchantment tonight with a gorgeous gibbous moon shining down on this amazing desert. But it was 80. Just an hour ago it was 80. So, Patrick, I think very warm weather is headed your way. Cynthia, what caused you to realize there are these apparent hiccups in time? Did you have personal awarenesses that things kind of sometimes didn't fit?
Yes, I've often, actually that's where the whole thing started for me, was noticing with the example of, for example, a sundial sculpture here in Berkeley where I live, down by the marina. It seemed like it had just, it had been there for a long time. At least it looks like it had been, but I didn't remember it having been there when I first saw it. And then when I read the plaque on this huge sundial sculpture, it professed to have been there for years. It was saying that it was a gift from a sister city in Japan to the city of Berkeley. And it was just this enormous thing made of concrete.
This is not where they do all the artwork on the flats in Emeryville. This is further up toward Berkeley?
Yeah, it's up toward Berkeley. Oh, good. You know where that is.
I used to live in Berkeley.
Awesome.
Yes.
You're not doing... Yeah, they used to do
college in Claremont. The Buttercup.
Awesome.
The Mars Project was born in the Buttercup. I'm sorry, inside baseball, folks, Well, we'll have to exchange, notes on Berkeley. So I don't remember something like that there in the marina.
Right. And that's what's so interesting, because I used to go have lunch with some friends. We'd meet down there in the marina. And
I mean, what are we physically talking about? Was this thing big and impressive, or was it something
huge
you had to kind of note it was there?
No, it's like 20 feet tall.
Oh, my. So it was a big hulking.
Okay. It's big, huge. It's a sundial that's so big you could climb on it. In fact, children would do that. They would just, jump up and crawl around.
So wait a minute. The pillar is the sundial, and its shadow is what's casting the telling the hours and all that. So it's a big, big thing, right?
That's right. And sundials, of course, they come in all sizes and shapes.
Well, this sounds like it's kind of a mega sundial, so how could you and I both not remember it?
Well, that was what
I don't remember that damn sundial. I was in Berkeley many years.
Right.
I love water, looking over at the bay, looking across, at the city. I don't remember that sundial.
Well, And what's so surprising is if you look at the dedication that's on that sundial, if you go to Berkeley now, you'll see that it claims that it had been a gift in the year 1970. And in fact, the thing does look old enough. You know, things get worn, they get weathered, they get kind of looking ancient, and it does. But the darndest thing is it just popped up one day as if it had always been there. And frankly, my friends and I had never, and you don't remember it either.
No.
And what's so interesting is it completely obscures another sculpture that's in the background. That's what first caught my attention. It's like, wait, what's this thing doing here? I mean, it's pretty large and it's surprising to see it there, but it also obscures the view.
So that was the first example that made you go, wait a minute, what's going on?
That was one of the big ones, right.
Okay.
I mean, frankly, I'd been noticing things earlier, but just like you said, it's you don't know what to do with it. It's like you have this strange experience, and you think at the time, well, that's a bit peculiar.
Well, Jung gave us this wonderful term that tells us absolutely nothing: synchronicity. What the hell is a synchronicity? It's just a term that's been applied to something that's going on. But what's really underneath the what's going on? That's what I want to get into tonight. So what were some of the other experiences that you noted the hiccups?
Another one was where my roommate's cat, Ashes, that she had told me had died. I didn't see it die. I wasn't there when it got supposedly hit by a car. But it actually, I believed her that he'd died because he'd been the household cat when I was living there. I'd since moved across the street. And interestingly, Ashes had been coming to visit me. So this is an alive again experience, back from the dead. This beautiful cat had been visiting me, you know, crossing Cedar Street is the street I lived on at the time. And he'd come over and visit. But after I heard the news of his death, I didn't expect to see him,
right,
of course. But then almost about a month later, after I'd heard from my roommate that he had died, I was just astonished to see him, Ashes, walking toward me in my backyard, just like he had been doing. He'd come and visit me. I know. And he looked a little bit dirtier than he used to be. And he seemed to have a little bit of joint difficulty, you know, kind of like arthritis or something.
Yeah.
But he was just totally alive. And I was so amazed.
Well, wait a minute. That opens up a question. If we're dealing with parallel realities, parallel universes, and somehow our consciousness is skipping like a phonograph record between these other realities, like these dimensions, maybe the times are not synchronized. So in that dimension where he's still alive, he's also older and he's got a bit of arthritis, etc. In other words, how do you know the times are synced?
Well, it's an interesting question. It seems like we can tune it in like a radio dial. And if I'd been missing him terribly because I felt like I hadn't gotten enough visiting times.
So wait a minute. Are you saying that you, because of your conscious longing, actually migrated to a universe where he was still around?
I'm saying that that's a possibility. I mean, this whole question of who are we really, this is what...
At any one time. I mean, Fred, our CEO here at the New Network, he constantly compares listeners to frogs in a wheelbarrow. And he has them constantly jumping in and out of the wheelbarrow. So you can't really count how many people are out there because they're always changing.
Exactly. That's a great way to look at it.
If we expand this to the Fred/Cynthia wheelbarrow metaphor of moving consciousness, my God, we could be jumping in and out of universes of wheelbarrows.
Just like little quantum bits.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it feels like. And when you pay attention to one particular thing, you can tune it in. So that does seem like that is happening.
Well, the only way we're going to catch this is by noticing the discontinuities. So I would think, I mean, the logical science part of me says, okay, you lived in Berkeley all those years, Hoagland, you didn't notice the big sundial. What's wrong with you? Or maybe it was there all along and I just was too damn, you know, focused on other stuff. So, well, what does one do? One conducts a survey. How many other people in Berkeley remember the sundial versus how many people say, what sundial?
And that's the kind of thing that's happening a lot now that this Mandela effect is gaining people's interest. You know, they are starting to step forward and say, This is something astonishing to them, because they will also remember that Nelson Mandela, for example, died in prison while he was incarcerated. So how is it possible that he died again just a couple of years ago? And what that video that we were pointing at, one thing that I discussed in the video is that I did another survey, a small survey this time in 2005, to find out who at that time were the most commonly reported celebrities that were alive again. In other words, they died, but people were noticing, hey, these guys are alive again. And this is before, this is 5 years before Nelson Mandela himself had been noticed alive again. So I also was curious to find out, what was Nelson Mandela doing if he wasn't indeed alive again in 2005? Mm-hmm. And actually, he was doing something pretty spectacular. He'd come out of some degree of obscurity to step forward and give a talk in 2005. He was giving a speech in Trafalgar Square to 20,000 people. At least that's what history says right now. You know, because obviously things, facts change, history changes. But back then, Mandela was calling for action to end unnatural poverty. And the speech was covered by BBC News, but I don't remember it.
I don't either. You're describing it. I'm thinking 20,000 people, they're making a big deal of Bernie Sanders having 20,000 and Donald Trump having. Why wouldn't Nelson Mandela, on in years, former president of South Africa, former survivor of all that era, why wouldn't we both remember 20,000 people in Trafalgar Square?
And my theory on that is, because we should, you know, actually that should have captured the U.S. news media too. Maybe it didn't. Maybe it was just more of a U.K. thing.
I mean, but I remember obscure stories like Bill Clinton going to Mandela's birthday party.
Right, right. And so you would think, like, oh, he's come out of his, you know, his time alone to kind of recuperating after all that time in prison, if he did indeed survive that. So he'd been lying low. I guess that's the story. Because I was wondering, what had he been doing before then? He'd just been kind of quiet. I guess he'd been released from jail. See, I don't remember any of that, because I remember he died in prison. But now he'd been freed. He'd been released, you know, it was quite a bit earlier, and he's stepping out again. So I think it's another indicator that possibly there's been a change in history itself. And this event that we don't remember might be not remembered because we, at that time, were still in that reality where he had, I don't know if you remember that he died while incarcerated, but
yeah, no, I don't. No.
Yeah.
Nope.
Maybe just sort of not really on your radar at that time.
I mean, the model for how this actually would work is so extraordinary, because it basically says the consciousness is gliding from quantum reality to quantum reality to quantum reality, and it's impelled by what? A natural process, or by volition, by consciousness, by longing, by love, by fear. In other words, if we're like when, remember, you've seen those skeeter bugs that walk on water?
Yes.
Is our consciousness just kind of skimming multiple realities? Do we go back and forth? There's a very famous Star Trek. In fact, it was the closing Star Trek of the entire series. And I forget the name, of course, at the critical time. But it had Picard in three separate time periods crossing between and relating events in each of those separate time periods to ultimately where they were all wound up going. So is our reality like that we basically, through volition, can jump sideways to another parallel universe?
It seems like that's the way nature operates, is that there's this amazing fluidity of being able to change events. You know, we think we can change the future. Of course, we assume we can. But what's interesting is it looks like we're actually able to experience changes in the past as well. So I'd say, yes, we're definitely skating along somewhere. And it raises that question again of what is consciousness and who are we if we're able to do that? And the thing that's really intriguing to me about the Nelson Mandela effect and that sort of thing, Berenstain Bears have been very popular, and another big, huge meme this last year, and that's the children's books, the Berenstain Bears. But what's happening that I think is so fascinating is now we're coming out of the closet, and it's not just you and your wife experiencing something bizarre, or just me or one of the listeners, but we're able to share, thanks to the internet and programs like this radio show, this whole notion that lots of us are remembering things a little bit differently.
Well, I want folks, you know, in a little while, maybe toward the in the second hour, to call in with their stories, their examples of this shift, this discontinuity. Because frankly, Cynthia, I'm thinking if that is going on, there should be other indicators, other pieces of evidence that kind of build a more complete model. In other words, I would imagine that if reality is that fragile, there are other parts that we observe that simply don't make sense because it's not what we think. It's not linear. It's not based on only one dimension.
Right. And I'd actually say that this kind of interesting way that reality can skip around is not actually fragile, but it's resilient. And I think this kind of resilience is built into that quantum nature of all of reality. And there's one other quick news story, if we have time before the next break.
Sure.
I just want to say, this one's fascinating because while I was doing the research on Nelson Mandela, I came across something strange that was happening in the United Kingdom at that time. This is also in that video that is right there on the other side of midnight, page on that we talked about, this page of facts and so forth. Radio with pictures.
Radio with pictures, uh-huh. Yes.
Yes. So when people play that, they can see for themselves that something bizarre happened at a town of Bolton at their museum and art gallery. And what happened was people in the town were split about 50-50 on whether there had ever been a full-scale model of a dinosaur that was right there greeting visitors to this exhibit.
Are we talking now in England?
Yeah, we're talking in England.
Okay.
And so one of the people that was these are not just crazy mixed up senior citizens that are doddering around and they don't know what's up. No, and I'm not putting people down, but the people that are remembering this dinosaur there were actually movers and shakers in the community, such as Alan Rushton, who is the leader of the conservative group on the Bolton City Council. He was one of the people that came forward and said, look, one of our dinosaurs is definitely missing. And he went on to say, am I supposed to accept that my eyes deceived me? Or this enormous dinosaur was a figment of my imagination. I remember as a schoolboy going on visits to the museum, standing in awe, looking at the dinosaur. And I raised the matter when I was on the arts committee, but we were never able to find any trace of it. See, he had assumed that someone had taken this thing down, put it in a closet somewhere, I don't know why, and it just, it should be put back out in its place of prominence. And then what happened was this huge discussion ensued in the town, and that's where the newspaper stepped in, running stories to find out, who remembered this thing. At first they were trying to find it, but then what they found was that half the people remembered, half the people of a certain age, I should say. So if they were alive back in the 1960s when people remembered having seen it, half the people would say, yes, for sure.
So this is a story which is well documented in local British newspapers, right?
Right, that's
with
right.
Known people, town fathers, people of credibility, people who are not conspiring for the world's biggest April Fool's joke, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And half the people, how big is this little town?
That's a good question. I didn't research the size of the community, but
it depends on your size of your sample, because if it's a few thousand people, like a typical little, English village, that's thousands of people who have different remembrance of a fundamental reality.
Right.
Thousands in one little place.
That's true.
How is this not the front page of the New York Times?
Well, because that's what I think we're just on the cusp of something here. Until this, it's just been in the last year, really, that the Mandela effect and the Berenstain Bears and this sort of thing has caught on to such a degree that people are coming out and sharing that they also remember things differently.
Well,
what
again,
happens is you don't have evidence of the other. All you've got is your memory. It's kind of like leave only footsteps, take only pictures, or whatever. Basically, when you travel through these alternate realities, you can't bring souvenirs with you. You can't bring photographic.
But evidence. Do you bring people that you love with you? Because Robin and I had a shared trans, whatever you want to call it, experience, transdimensional, and it's the damnedest thing. And I'll tell that in the second hour. But it's like we both went through it. Even Morala went through it with us. So, and I have another friend lives up on the west coast of California. He and his wife are driving, and they should be dead because he described an experience where literally they had to have shifted dimensions Otherwise, they would have been smashed in a car on a freeway at 60, 70 miles an hour. And that was one of our first conversations that he kind of delicately brought this up to me, but he didn't call it by any name. He just described, and I realized when you and I talked on the air the last time, oh my God, my friend had a Mandela effect with his wife because she shared the experience. Right. So how do you bring other souls with you as you're jumping around by Kickapoo in the, you know, multi-universes of, what was his name? Very famous writer, sci-fi writer. It'll come to me.
We do it through, again, going back to that quantum idea of entanglement. So, and you talked about Bose-Einstein condensates and so forth. So when there's this joining together, when there's this, love seems to be the entanglement.
I was going to say, people, consciousness has to become entangled.
It does.
Otherwise, you couldn't make the trip together.
And people may be listening, and they might be thinking they haven't heard of any of these things. I'd like to mention some of these. And
please call in.
Okay.
Everybody who has had something like this happen, I know you'll be stacked up over Idlewild, but we'll do this more because I want to really hone in on this. This is so incredibly intriguing as an answer to a lot of other mysteries.
Right. And when you look at movies, if you remember that beautiful baseball film.
Oh, yeah.
That line, if you build it, they will come.
That's the other movie, the other baseball movie.
Yeah, people talk about, you know, if you build it, they will come. I think Kevin Costner was in it. And the line is the way that we remember it because that was the way that dialogue went in the movie.
Well, hang on. But there's also a scene in the movie I remember after he's built it, after this ghostly team shows up and the game is running, you see a long shot from the cameraman down across the valley, down across, and you see this line of cars winding through the mountains coming toward the field. If you build it, they will come. It was the affirmation in the film of that aphorism.
And it makes sense. Yes,
Total sense.
Now, if people, the reason we're harping on this is because if you listen to the dialogue now and you watch the movie, even though auspiciously there's been no change to the film, supposedly, it says, if you build it, he will come.
Amazing.
And I don't know why on earth that would even make sense.
No, it doesn't. Because the whole idea was to convince him to build it. It was economically impossible. Why do it? In other words, the only reason to do it is if other people would notice and would be able to benefit from what they were doing. So the whole structure of the plot doesn't make sense. He will come. It was they.
It has to be they. Otherwise, the whole
because he already had showed up. You know,
one person, it's a disaster.
Yeah. So why are we remember? And how many people remember it two different ways? And please let me know tonight. Call in. Let me know.
Yeah.
I want to know.
Yeah.
Because we have no stats on this. And to me, it's a window into something so cool and so potentially revealing.
Absolutely. And people remember Star Wars. That's another good one. And there's a famous scene where there's this discussion between Luke and Darth Vader where he finally gets the chance, the two of them, to talk, you know, to each other about this relationship they have. And what I remember, and most, I was a huge Star Wars fan. You know, I went to see that movie when the first Star Wars came out. I sat in the theater three times in a row. I didn't leave the theater. It was amazing.
Likewise.
Yeah. So in the scene where Darth Vader's talking to Luke, what I remember is he says, Luke, with this dark, you know, that amazing voice, Luke. I am your father. But if you play that scene now, it's totally different. It's just, no, I am your father. I'm laughing.
No?
Like, yeah, there's no way it could be that. But that's what it says now. No,
I remember Luke, I am your father. And that was the big reveal.
Luke. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense unless he says Luke.
Right. And it doesn't sound right.
Nope.
And that's what I remember. It feels right. You know, you can hear the resonance. You feel the resonance in your body when you're in the theater. I did. And it's just an experience. But the word no, it doesn't sound right.
No, it was a huge reveal. They had the battle and he's hanging there on the edge of the spire and he's again over emptiness and space and this confrontation. And it's this, oh my God, this personification of evil. I'm that kind of thing.
Right.
No, I'm, you know, would not do it at all.
No.
As any scriptwriter would know, worth his or her salt. So has anybody done a survey of scriptwriters and said which line works better?
Well, I think we're getting to the point where we should be doing that and check in with. That's a great idea. I'd love to know.
Yeah.
But it's not just the script writers, you know, it's just, I think everybody has a right to an opinion on that, because we have fans, you know, people that love Star Wars, and I'd love to know what they think, too. You know, so those are a couple of examples that our listeners could mention when they call.
We got about 4 minutes till the station ID at the top of the hour. Give us some more, because to me, and until you introduced me to this idea, I never really organized these experiences into, wait a minute, could that really be?
That's right. There are a bunch of these. You know, people are noticing things like.
Why don't we talk about the bears? Because I'd never heard about Berenstain or Berenstain or Berenstain bears at all.
Okay.
Ever.
Well, it comes up if you're a parent or if you're a kid reading these books. These
I was one of those. Yes, I'm on one side of that equation. Yes.
Yeah.
Never heard of the bears.
And if you were a child in the '60s, you might not have seen the books because
'50s.
Yeah, so probably not. They came along a little later, but with my daughters who were children of the 90s, I definitely got the Berenstain bears. And notice I said Berenstain.
I noticed.
And so the big discussion was always, is it Berenstain or Berenstain? Because these look like Jewish bears,
sure,
maybe.
Sure.
You know, it's S-T-E-I-N.
Well, German
I'm
Jewish
laughing.
Bears.
It's like, okay, well, that's cool. Well, whatever. But now, if you go to look at these children's books, you go to the library or the bookstore, or Amazon, you're going to notice it's spelled Berenstain, like stain, like you remove a stain with a stain remover. And so now it's not ever going to be a Berenstain or Berenstain, it's only Berenstain. And that's just wrong.
Okay, let me ask you a really obvious and dumb question, at least dumb from my perspective. Well, if this is all going on, there's a kind of a rising appreciation, oh my God, look at that, and people compare notes and all that. Why aren't there multiple websites of people avidly posting their latest examples all over the planet?
Well,
we're in 107 nations tonight.
Yeah, there are some places. All these years, I've been collecting firsthand reports from people. So I've had a huge archive of these stories on my realityshifters.com website since it started in 1999. That's 17 years of these things. And recently, Reddit, of course, is picking up a lot of these. There's also that website by Fiona Broom, which is the Mandela Effect website. And she, for a while, I think she still is reporting things that people post there. And so there are lots of these websites. They're becoming much more of a common phenomenon. You know, people are starting to share their stories. And as they do so, they're coming together as a community and recognizing something big is happening. And when people first notice it, it is hair raising. I mean, it makes your hair stand on end.
Mm.
You get these goosebumps. And
The way Robin and I deal with it, and it's happened more than once, it's like we say, okay, calm down, just wait, it will come back. And it does. And we're at the top of the hour, station ID up ahead. My guest this morning, Cynthia Sue Larson, say that real fast. We're talking about alternate realities. There's a reality where I said that absolutely perfectly first time around. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we have returned. We're on the other side of midnight. Gorgeous gibbous moon up there. So, Cynthia, what are some of these stories? Because I'm dying to know how people are responding. Because to me, when we kind of realized there had to be something really bizarre going on, our reaction was, well, kind of just wait and it'll kind of come around and bingo, the thing you can't find anywhere in the house is right there.
Right. And that's the way that's something that a lot of people do notice at home on their own. So these are personal reality shifts, personal experiences of this quantum nature of reality. And, you know, absolutely. I've been sharing different tips and pointers for people to find things for years because that's one of the practical applications of this whole phenomenon, is that you don't need to consider something lost and gone forever. Even if it fell off in the middle of the ocean somewhere, it can still show up in your house in some random place later. And there are ways to help encourage that to happen. So I like the practical side of all this. I like the hopeful side. I know it sounds crazy, right? It's like, but I know this thing fell off a cruise ship.
Well, no, I'm just thinking, I lost a pair of favorite socks. Actually, no, I lost one of them. Does this bifurcation, bilocation, entanglement only apply to one of a pair of socks? Because they never seem to come and go together. You're always missing one.
Right. And that was something that first came in when I started the website, was the most common example. When people thought, oh, this doesn't happen to me, I would remind them, or I'd actually ask them, what about those missing socks and misplaced keys? And then they're like, oh, then they realize this does happen to me. But because these things are considered trivial, unless it is your favorite pair of socks, most people think, well, I'm forgetful, or maybe it doesn't make any sense, but they might think their washing machine eats socks. And that doesn't make any sense.
No. Although I did hear an interesting hyperspace theory about coat hangers, that as opposed to socks, which disappear one at a time into some other dimension, coat hangers actually multiply. They clone each other.
That is funny.
Okay, so in the couple of minutes we got left, hit me with a couple of stories. What's the most remarkable story you've had?
Well, I think the most remarkable are the ones where a couple of people have seen themselves going in opposite direction on a road.
Oh, my God, you got it. That's a biggie.
That is pretty big. And they do a double take, like, that's my exact weird car and the same thing strapped on the roof, and that's me. And it's just freaky, really freaky. And it's
so, do they follow themselves?
If the other person doesn't notice,
do they follow themselves? Do they meet themselves?
No, usually they're like, in the couple of cases where this has happened, they've been returning to go pick something up, and then they see themselves as if either on the first way.
Oh, it's like they were out of sync in time. Remember, I said before the realities may not be all synced up. Christ, why would they?
They're not. And I've seen people. I've seen the glitch in the Matrix effect, where a sequence of events repeats. That's another very bizarre phenomenon that can occur.
So, and we're going to, have time to address this before the break, but, as a quantum physicist, as a physicist dealing with this at the level of our knowledge base now, how do we differentiate between a natural universe where there's multiples of us and events and realities and narrations and all kinds of stunning, soap opera, or a universe in which some kid somewhere has basically got us in a program, and he's bored, so he's cloned off the program and set up a different reality, and somehow consciousness has come to inhabit his video game. That's Elon's model, and I can't tell you which is easier to solve or which is easier to live in. We're at the top of the hour, shortly after. 3 minutes gone, and we will be back. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And we are back with Cynthia Sue Larson this morning. I've got so many questions, and I really want to this morning kind of drill down into the mechanics of how this would work. If in a small town in England, about half the people who were polled or discussed or had conversation or their comments were put on the record that they did not remember the big dinosaur at the museum, and the other half did, that means at any one time, half of us are in maybe a reality which is not our own?
Well, that's one way to look at it. On this page, Radio with Pictures, if people look down a little bit under the video, I've got a slide there that says self-similarity, being of two minds,
okay,
living in
yeah.
a superposition of states.
Link number two, click on that. That will make it big.
It helps to make it big. Because
mm-hmm.
then you can see there's a picture. The illustration on the left is showing a scientist in one reality. He's working on his computer, doing something important, looks like. And then this other reality, he's out doing his favorite hobby pastime, which is bird watching. And there's a little caption, the quantum life being in two places at the same time. So this illustration accompanies a quote from that had come from this physicist, Maximilian Schlosshauer. And basically he was summarizing the results of a survey that they conducted in 2011, where the physicists at the conference agreed that all objects can exist in superposed states. And the number of physicists that agreed with that was more than two-thirds. And they believed that there's no fundamental limit to quantum theory, that it should be possible for objects, no matter how big, to be prepared in quantum superpositions like Schrödinger's cat. So the arrow or quantum theory was associated only with the atomic realm appears finally over. And so that's what it's really saying, that on some level, this would explain things like bilocation, which has happened to me. And so, you know, otherwise bilocation sounds crazy. How could you be in two places at once? This superposition of states is showing us that if you're daydreaming, there's a really strong possibility that someone might actually witness you out and about doing what you are daydreaming, because that did happen to me a couple of times.
Good heavens. I mean, this really gives one the feeling that reality can be incredibly impermanent. And if it's so, if this is going on all around us, again, why haven't we been comparing notes? I mean, if you're living in a small community and people are popping in and out, the same person you met yesterday is not that person today, but another version that's kind of temporary. When you move between universes, what happens to the consciousness inhabiting the body of the person that the other people around you think you are, but you're no longer that person, you're someone who just kind of moved in?
Okay, and this gets back to that question, who do we think we are? And this really has to be the main question. So if you think you are that body and that you're just that particular persona, like a puppet, and instead of identifying with the consciousness, in other words, if you're taking more the materialist viewpoint rather than the spiritualist or the conscious awareness viewpoint, then it's going to be unnerving to the extreme. So for those people who are coming into this discussion already presuming or assuming or believing that we are primarily conscious beings, that the consciousness is who we really are, then it doesn't seem quite as weird. I mean, it's still pretty weird, but it becomes something that you can imagine, like, okay, there's some reason for this then.
Well, the alternative is you have to imagine that you're creating all of these realities, and at some level, it's like your private playground to where you move between, like, the audio animatronic things at you know, down at Disney World, and that you inhabit them sequentially, or do we inhabit them all simultaneously? In other words, very quickly, this whole concept becomes very, very prone to a headache.
Yeah, we don't have a way to, that's what I said earlier, that we don't have a way to study consciousness and to get into this and really understand it. We need one. So then you've got statements like Elon Musk, who, of course, he's going to go to what he understands, which would be an algorithm, and say, like, well, of course, we're just living in this sort of a simulation.
Well, his reasoning is actually pretty interesting. And if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and click on that third link, that's Musk's actual quote. His model was very interesting, very simple. You know, you and he and I all grew up in the same era to where we remember Pong?
Right, I do.
And then look at video games now. They actually, even some years ago, they wrote and designed a video game around my Cydonia research. A nice little group up there in Seattle. The sophistication that changed between then, which was roughly when I met Robin, which was what, 1998, 99, and now is stunning. So Musk's theory is, if we can chart this development in our own experience, at some point simulations, virtual reality, will become perfect. You will not be able to tell what's real and what's not. So his then question is, if that's true, then at some point you can insert AI simulacrums into that reality. And if that's true, at what point, in other words, his cascade of cause and effect leads you to the idea, maybe it's inevitable, so how do you tell?
And that gets back to the ancient yogis and gets back to the people that believe consciousness is primary and that have a sense that you can tell. when there's that feeling of reality, of meaning, of purpose, of all these things that are indescribable in a scientific experiment because you can't measure them, can't predict them, can't say, okay, we can predict the presence or absence of consciousness. You can't do that. So that Elon Musk is clever, but the cleverness, it's kind of missing the wisdom piece. It's missing the piece of where is this ghost in the machine? Where is the consciousness? And he's assuming that we're going to not be able to tell the difference. And I'm saying, I don't think so. So I agree with him. I really respect Elon Musk, but this is an area where I would say definitely we can tell.
Well, the thing I find so incredible is not just his model, but the idea that he's discussing it in public, unashamedly asking things that even a few years ago, nobody would have the courage to ask. He's that talking about like reality.
Good. Glad he's raising the discussion. I love it. I love that. That part is really cool.
Okay. Now, someone's calling in. If you haven't updated your Skype, I'm not able to connect you because it doesn't. If I connect you, I lose everybody else. So I can't do that. So make sure your Skype is updated. You know how to do that. Go to help and look at help for updates, and you can update Skype. Or you can call me on a regular phone, and maybe that will work. So what's link number 3 under your section? When I notice reality shifts, I often feel ...
Exactly. Now, this is a cartoon image, and it just shows what some of the most common emotional reactions are. Emotions tell us where, this is how we know we're human.
Oh, this is kind of like a bell curve of reactions. Think of it as a big lump,
It's a big lump. And so the most common reaction would be the ones in the middle, which is curious. Usually people's response. You mentioned that you and Robin had a very interesting experience, and probably you were curious. That's the most.
Well, it wasn't the first one. It was like, damn it, not now. I'm trying to do a damn conference, So, okay. Yeah, so we've got most people grouped in the middle, awe, curious, people, happy, excited.
Exactly.
The outliers are angry and scared.
Right.
Interesting.
It is interesting. So,
they're very small numbers.
They are very small. So typically when people notice reality shifts...
So if they're awed and curious, why don't we know more about it? Why isn't it a common subject? Like, do you remember a movie some years ago called The Fifth Element?
I love that. Yes, I do.
Which is basically this premise.
That's right. And I think there's been a tremendous interest in parapsychology, metaphysics for centuries,
I'm talking where people actually meet and agree reality is going on right here, right now. That's in other words, we have all this discussion, but it's at the periphery. At the core of our conversation right now as a civilization is, should we elect one hated person over another hated person? isn't that kind of like, it's almost Keystone Cops.
Right.
We're reduced to that.
Well, when people understand that you can actually bilocate, that you can be in that superposition of states, what the daydreaming self can be observed by others, that's what I'm telling you. It's happened to me a couple of times. Then you start understanding that the things that shamans have told us since before recorded history is true. That these kinds of effects in reality are quite real. And so humans for thousands of years have expected that we can witness miracles, that we can witness changes, that healing can
occur. Okay, now here's an interesting question. At least I hope it is. We're going to find out. If we're constantly all shifting realities, let's say we have a situation in our midst like Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter announced last year he had cancer, he was going to die, he was under treatment, etc. The worldwide reaction, including from this audience, was, no, that can't happen. And a few months later, Jimmy Carter basically says, I no longer have cancer. Now, it's attributed to the drugs he's under. He's under a specific kind of immunotherapy. There are some people, myself included, who think that the whole consciousness thing, reaching out and trying to connect through community, like the Einstein-Rosen connection, that has an effect. So maybe we had an effect energetically and, quote, we helped him cure himself. Or, third possibility, all of those people that want to see Jimmy Carter still alive, surviving his cancer, migrated via their own consciousness to a universe where Jimmy Carter is alive and no longer has cancer.
Right. And that's the one that the physicists would tend to agree with. They would say, that's the many worlds is the multiverse. Yes, all these realities are simultaneously coexisting, and we tend to be in the ones that are most interesting to us. You might not say you want this reality, but there are parts, there are aspects of yourself that are most intrigued by that reality that you're in. Most entangled with it, most engaged. And that's why you might wonder, like, why is it that when you particularly can't stand a certain actor or celebrity, they seem to be the ones that come back to life?
Really?
It's because you well, some people notice that.
Let me see who I want to get rid of that I can't stand as an actor. I shouldn't do that.
Yeah, don't say it on the
no,
air.
No, so okay, let's go to link number 4. And Mike, you keep calling, but your Skype is not letting me connect you. Otherwise, I'll lose everybody else. So you've got to update your Skype. So item number 4, Cynthia.
Now, this is interesting. We're looking at the two survey results side by side that were done through the Reality Shifters website. And this is surveying hundreds of people.
And now, tell me about the website again, slowly.
RealityShifters.com.
Okay, cool name.
So right after the website got started, the year 2000, we conducted a survey to find out how common is it and what are the most commonly observed types of reality shifts. In other words, interaction between mind and matter, consciousness and reality. And at that time, with 95% of the survey respondents reporting, they noticed synchronicity and coincidences. And that was absolutely the number one most commonly reported reality shift, where you just think about something and wow, you know, you think of a friend, they phone, or they show up. And then some of the other top most commonly observed.
The parking place, Barry.
Yes, finding parking places where you need them. This does happen quite a lot. And people, it's like a minor miracle. It's not something that you, except if you're in New York City or a big
city. So in 2000, 78% report this as significant. In 2013, 83%.
Yeah, that one's gone up and kind of significantly. So it seems like people are, but you now, if you look at what's happened between 2000 and 2013, a lot of things have happened. What the Bleep Do We Know came out.
Well, I was also going to say, in 13 years, from 2000 to 2013, maybe people who never wanted to find a parking place suddenly need to find parking places. So, see what I mean?
Right.
Population, number of cars.
Sure.
How do you normalize? You know, this is important as a kind of a process thing, because people might think it's easy to get to the bottom of this. No, it's not. It's how you phrase the question. It's the time of day. It's all the variables you're not smart enough to think of, or you have too much hubris and you think you've covered everything and you're missing something really important and not even obvious.
And actually, like we keep mentioning this throughout the entire interview tonight, facts change anyway. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's a reproducibility crisis right now in most all of the sciences, including psychology and pretty much everything. And that what I'm saying is that when an experiment is reproduced by another group or another laboratory, they don't necessarily get the same results. And it's quite vexing for a lot of scientists, because, you know, if once you report a scientific finding, you want to be able to.
Well, I mean, that's huge, because the tenet of science is that things are reproducible. There are such things as constants, atomic constants, the speed of light, mass, inertia, energy relationships. If that isn't constant, if it changes, which of course is the HD torsion field model, folks, then all bets are off. And even in the so-called hard sciences, like, for instance, they're measuring radioactivity decay rates. Cynthia, do you know that there's very odd results now in certain radioactive decay measurements? They're not connecting with the canonical textbook, half-life is this long?
Yeah, I've seen that some of the, well, I didn't hear about that one, but I've heard some of the other things that people had thought were just, you know, like constants are actually a little bit different. There have been some variations in the so-called constants.
Now, Sheldrake has published a major paper somewhere. I've probably got to find it by Googling on this idea. So it was interesting.
And that would totally fit with what we're talking about.
It was interesting to see that he came to the idea independently, because I hadn't read him and he hadn't read me. But we both heard of the idea that there are some physical constants that are not constant, and that's what makes the hyperdimensional model work. Consciousness as part of that inconstancy, where we migrate from universe to universe. I mean, what are the parameters? What makes us wind up in a certain place with a certain group of people?
And what I would just propose that nature finds this to be the way to evolve. What we're noticing in the fields of quantum cognition and quantum biology is that all of nature does seem to operate this way. That, for example, with if you just take a look at the idea of cognition, you know, we are definitely thinking in a quantum way. Our memory works that way. And we also make decisions that way, according to basically quantum, calculations. And then in the realm of quantum biology, our DNA replicates in a very kind of a quantum process. It makes these huge jumps, and organisms can instantly adapt to an environment that they've never been exposed to. So it's against all odds. And so you can see when you look at it that way, that it would make a certain degree of sense for us to be able to instantaneously jump to a reality that we need, that we have a built-in survival mechanism that way as a species.
Are you familiar with a concept in, I don't know whether it's reincarnation or it's a larger concept, but it's called soul constructs or soul complexes?
No.
It came out about a dozen. Whitley Strieber brought it to my attention. I tell you what, we've got someone calling, so let me put my question on hold. We will add this person to our little community tonight. Good morning. You're on the air.
This is Robin from Minnesota.
Hi, Robin.
I don't know if you remember several months ago when your guest was on first. It was my first call to the show, and I mentioned that most of these effects that we're observing are the result of a time war.
Of a time war. Yes, I remember your model of a huge galactic or even maybe interdimensional time war. Okay.
Right. Well, basically, the battlefield of this time war is probability, probable timelines. And the effect that you're observing mostly is sort of almost a background noise in this. But in the sandstorm, there is something known as the wind of change. Now, the sandstorm is actually the word for the warfare that occurs in probability. And the weapons are incredibly devastating that are, you know, there are a near infinite number of alternate probable timelines, which is another way of saying that they're all quantum timelines. Mm-hmm. But the weapons in this war are so destructive that they can occasionally, it's necessary to obliterate an entire timeline. And when that occurs in the sandstorm, that produces something known as the sandstorm wind of change. Now, this wind of change does not occur up and down the timeline, it occurs perpendicularly to the timeline. And that's...
So wait a minute, are there effects then felt in adjacent timelines?
Yes, when one is destroyed like this, anything that's relatively close to it, the timeline gets fragged, the main timeline...
Robin, you understand this sounds like something right out of Doctor Who.
Well, you know, I've been involved with this thing sort of, inadvertently and not of my, entirely my own free will. This thing is as real as any of the alien abduction phenomena, probably more real. It's sort of on a higher level, actually.
I'll tell you what, we only got about 3 minutes till the bottom of the hour. Why don't I hold you over and you tell us a couple of these experiences? Because frankly, if we're looking at a phenomenology, rather than backing into it and saying that this fits that, if we look at the evidence and then try to see which model it's more appropriate to. Cynthia, do you have any questions before we go to break?
Oh, let's see. Well, it's an interesting observation. I think regardless how you feel about that time war idea, you can certainly look at it like you're suggesting, Richard, from the viewpoint of how would the theories work? And
You must understand that there are, some of these could be simultaneous. Some of the small effects, your personal effects, could be, or even small group effects, those are rather minor.
So wait a minute, are you saying that the personal stuff we've been talking about, things missing, coming back, people popping in and out of your life, you're saying that that's kind of like turbulence as a side effect?
That's sort of a normal... You know, some of that is the result of the sandstorm warfare, but actually, when you have the cosmology of the it's known as the big time, when you have that cosmology, there are quite a few different places with the, it's a cosmology that makes, our conventional scientific cosmology look somewhat primitive, and it's difficult to explain because I'm faced with the same situation as all of my peers are, like a medieval, it's very primitive to what the cosmology that I've been able to reach and actually are a part of,
I'll tell you what, Robin, we're coming up to a break. Why don't you send me this as a PDF or document
or
something?
Yeah, I've been trying to.
Hang on.
Formulating a letter, an email to you for quite some time.
Just hang on there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a quick break, and then we shall be back with my guest, Cynthia Sue Larson, and Robin, who has a very interesting theory, which could be right or not, and it's all about evidence and science. Here on the other side of midnight, we shall return. And welcome back on this Thursday morning in the land of enchantment. Gorgeous full moon out there. Actually, it's a gibbous, but it kind of looks full if you don't look at it really close. So, Robin, your model is, for those folks that missed you the last time you were on, is that we're kind of at the periphery of some titanic time war between the equivalent of what, a Type 3 super civilization or two of them?
Well, actually, you have to understand this, the cosmology of the time war. Actually, Proteus, the organization that I'm in, would be what you would call a class 9. And it's the main warfare now is that we're sort of fighting a class 6. So you have to understand all these higher levels of cosmology in order to really understand Proteus can create meta-universe dimension, But at our level, there are timelines that become an entire timeline can become predatory and attempt to eat up all of its neighbors, and those kind of timelines get obliterated, Proteus has a time base, some distance in the past, attempts to maintain,
so,
at least.
So if I understand, you are here on Earth, a human who is part of an organization fighting a time war. You understand, Robin?
Time war that's always been, by the way.
You understand how that sounds, right?
Right. It sounds like science fiction, but then again, we're slowly beginning to learn that there's a core of truth in a lot of the science fiction out there. And basically, a lot of the science fiction is simply describing events in an alternate timeline.
Okay, so you were presumably born an ordinary kid in some place in Kansas.
Right.
How did you wind up in the middle of a time war working
for
a group
called Proteus? Pretty much like you, okay? With the same kind of scientific background. I was known as Professor Robin in the second grade, the big book of science and all of that, and I had a conventional thing. I went to the university towards an electrical engineering degree. I sort of ran out of money started my senior year and got a job as a technician and never really got back to complete the degree, but I worked at some fairly high level engineering jobs. And, And I've been developing this stereo system and computer stereo system in the basement of the house here. And like I said before, we live very close to the WCCO transmitting antenna, which is, by the way, a pyramid, believe it or not.
Yes. I tell you what, I want to get back to Cynthia, but
sure.
In your experience, how did you, A, the question is, A, how did you wind up working for this organization? And B, have you, as part of this this reality experience these kind of jumps like the rest of us appear to be experiencing?
Well, normally the jumps that I experience are the great big ones, like the entire timeline will be radically different. And those are the ones that Proteus immediately changes back to more or less what the timeline should be.
And what causes these timeline changes?
Well, there are various things, but mainly there are other adversaries out there that want the timeline to be completely different.
So you're saying the alternate...
You know that one of the names for the gray aliens are the Children of the Sun. Well, there are a lot of... One of the groups in the Time War are known as the Children of the Clock, if you can believe that. And they want a completely different timeline.
Well, remember the Nazi bell was, and under the Nazi designation, the Glock, the clock.
Right.
Cynthia,
right.
Have you ever encountered anything like this?
Like the Children of the Sun, or like
in other words, he is saying that we're at the mercy of a huge adversarial system, and that these jumps, these hiccups, these changes in the matrix are part of something so big and so vast that most people could not even begin to believe it could be real.
I'd agree that there is definitely a Jungian archetypal or archetypal sort of a construct that a lot of people that are creating some of the science fiction movies and books are tapping into, and they're definitely picking up on something that there much of a peaceful sort of a sensation. So I'd agree with that on a feeling level, we can feel something is going on, and we can resonate with the truth of that there absolutely feels like there's not complete agreement with all parts of ourselves as to where things are going. And this is for those people that are thinking in terms of, well, what's real? How can we know what's real? You look at someone
and the Time War goes through, it's sort of in a quiescence. It goes through periods of activity and then it quiets down for a while. And you must, one of the first things that disappears when the Time War becomes active is the very fact that there is such a thing as a Time War. How can you fight in the Time War in a war like this if all that information nearly completely disappears? And that's what happens when Time War becomes active again.
Well, Robin, it makes sense from a quantum perspective because retrocausal effects are commonplace in a quantum multiverse. I mean, this is what happens. Yeah. You can absolutely get that time. Get a handshake through time. And
each
what
of
that
these
does,
quantum universes are what we call a timeline universe, okay? And that's basically, you know, there are... not an infinite number, there are a near infinite number that all together form what's known as a meta-universe. Now, the meta-universe, think of the card catalog in a library, which is a meta-index. The meta-universe points, I guess you would say, at each of the timeline universes. But all this together forms a bubble, okay, that's expanding since the Big Bang. Now, the next level up is something known as the multiplex, or unqualified infinity, the internal multiplex, and our meta universe is simply a bubble in this larger eternal multiplex. So there's another completely higher, and each of these meta universe within the multiplex have their own set of timeline probabilities.
This almost sounds, Cynthia, like the Urantia Project.
Urantia is another. Is one of these other bubble universes.
That's what
you know, although Urantia would claim to be everything, but they're a young one.
Gets back to Musk and him claiming that we can't be in the base reality. And then the question is, how would we know?
Well, basically what he's looking at is one of these other players in the Time War. To muddle the water further, there are these, the movie The Matrix. Well, the big computer in that.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of things like that are very old out in our timeline universe, and occasionally we sort of fall into one of those things, you know. if you can imagine.
Wait. We like fall. The, you know, what, that, you, what, Robert? What do you mean we fall that, into one of those things?
That were well, they become active. The very powerful artificial intelligence things from that are completely at a different level. You know, there are many levels to the dimensionality that we experience, and you know that not you know there are I guess you would there are simulacra or the older kind of, but they're completely different from the.
Tell you what, send
you know,
me
from the actual Time War itself.
Send me the manuscript. Send it to Enterprise Mission, and I will read it. And we will probably need to have another conversation.
Well, you know, I'm getting old, and I don't know how much. You know, I've written quite a lot on this, but the Time War becomes deadly, and since I'm deeply involved with it, I'm one of the primary targets, it would seem, you know. When,
so
when
I would say I would
active.
Say you should email it very quickly.
Okay.
Thank you, Robin.
Sure.
Cynthia, let me ask you this question. If there are multiple realities, is an intuitive idea that as you go further from yours, things get stranger, kind of real? In other words, if you only migrate two or three realities, you won't even notice that your cat has another scar or that the strawberries you bought, you know, have a different label or that kind of thing.
Right. And the kind of things we typically notice, and the reason I'm mentioning these Mandela effects where there's a social awareness, is that we start paying more attention to it and start, therefore, bringing our attention into the possibility that these things can happen. And then we start hopefully seeing things that, you, as you say, are more commonplace. And on that level, I personally experience these really often, you know, at least one a day of a type of reality shift that, because the more you pay attention, the more you notice something moved. It's not where I put it. You know, the missing sock, the keys moving around the house, that kind of thing. And then when you look at these, this whole Mandela effect meme, and you take a look at things such as the ones we've discussed about Berenstain Bears, and that if you build it, they will come, kind of a dialogue from the movie and these sorts of things, then we notice that we're moving between realities. We're doing it through our consciousness. And for that reason, we don't really need to get alarmed about these, you know, people are concerned about, oh my gosh, that sounds scary about the
so
time war.
So if our range of motion is right. Kind of limited, like, you know, if you let kids out, you know, who have been inside for like, you know, 2 or 3 days, so, you know, not able to go to school, too much snow and all that, you let them out, they'll go as far as they can. So in terms of the timelines, does our consciousness only have a certain range so the things don't get too unfamiliar? Because I don't remember people I knew, close friends, popping in and out of existence and dying one day and coming back 3 weeks later. So if that's not common, it means there must be some rules for how much change is permitted by whatever laws are governing this.
That's right. And you're hitting the nail on the head. I've heard that in Brazil, in certain places, it used to be true that deceased family members would show up for holidays and knock on the door and come in to the house.
Oh,
and that was considered normal. And I haven't followed up. I don't know. I've never heard of from a firsthand report of this, but I think that's fascinating. And then in Norway, they've got a word called Vardeager, which is to arrive before, you know, to get there before you arrive.
Oh, my God. That reminds me of that very fun limerick. There once was a lady named Bright who could travel faster than light. She left one day in a relative way and arrived the previous night.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you know that you're tuning into something when you notice that there are cultures that have words for this, and it's not something that was created with CERN because it predates, you know, because that's one of the theories you might hear about. And there are lots of conspiracy theories that somehow we've started up something horrible.
Well, if we have started a lot of torsion field technology recently,
right.
In the last,
right.
Let's say, several decades, that would do one hell of a thing to a timeline or a set of timelines, because that energy is the fundamental basis of the timelines. So, yeah, I would say that we're causing. And it's not us inadvertently, you know, back to what Robin said. The reason I don't dismiss him as some kind of wild, cracked idiot, because we're so far beyond the edge of the paper and into the twilight zone, with ruins on Mars and on Pluto, and secret space programs and people, you know, tapping phones at will anywhere on the planet, following any information. Is it that unusual to think that maybe if there really are amazing, incredible civilizations, the control of time would be the ultimate way to control your foes and your enemies? Simply erase them. I mean, think of the Marvel Universe. Think of Thor and the Dark Universe and all that stuff. Is that, in fact, trying to tell us that these realities are actually real in some timelines?
Yeah, that like I told Robin, I think that that's definitely sounds feasible on a certain level, and it makes sense, and you can see signs of it right in the I was referring to these archetypes, these ideas that most of us resonate with, and it has that kind of a feeling to it that it feels like, wow, that might actually be true.
I want to talk to some other people who've had this experience. Our Skype numbers, 505-796-8802. Enterprise Mission, if you're on Skype, or The Other Side of Midnight. Skype, 505-796-8802. If you've had one of these shifting reality things, experiences, and you've never known who to talk to, tonight's your chance, tonight's your opportunity. We will listen, and I promise we will not laugh. Nothing is too beyond belief now, given the data that we're basically looking at.
And you mentioned that you'd had an experience with this sort of thing yourself.
Yeah, Robin and I went down. I was invited to speak at Stephen Greer's, one of his meetings, you know, Contact in the Desert. Or, I don't think that's the title, but it's close. He basically takes people through a kind of a presentation, and then he uses lasers to try to communicate to ships that might be perched off, you know, in the ionosphere or somewhere, and he's hoping for close flybys and all that. So I went down before that evening session to give a normal presentation on stage. And when you're at a conference, you know, there's a lot of things that happen at conferences. You have to check in. You got to make sure all your stuff is, you know, kind of within earshot or eyesight or whatever. And you're going to public rooms. You want to like leave things around. And you've got, you know, documents. You've got briefcases. You've got, you know, video gear. So we went into the restaurant one night to have kind of a dinner with a bunch of our friends and colleagues. And at the end of the evening, we left the restaurant, went back to the room, and we noticed that we were missing, I think it was Robin's pocketbook, or a pocketbook. It was some kind of bag she had. And I thought, we left it in the restaurant. So I went back. Nothing there. Talked to the cleanup crew. Cleanup crew hadn't seen anything. So we, you know, the next day, conference, you know, early morning speech, breakfast and all that, same dining room, lots of people milling around, cleaning crew, doing, you know, those little dustpan thingies, nothing. Evening of the second or third day of the conference, we gathered at that table. You know, however, everywhere you go to a conference, sometimes in the restaurant, you and your friends will pick kind of a favorite table, and you'll kind of hang out at that table during the whole weekend that you're there. That's what we did. So we're at this same table where the bag had been under it and it was missing. And we sit down, and Robin looks down, and there's the bag. Now, I had been there twice, the morning breakfast, the cleaning crew and all that. If that bag had been found and turned into lost and found, it obviously would not have been under the table waiting to be found. So what happened, Cynthia? Did we move? And did we move? How many of the people of that conference did we move with us as we changed timelines to where that bag reappeared?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And we don't know in terms of which of the quantum theories and models is the one. But yeah, exactly. There are many possibilities. And this is obviously something that you really needed. You're entangled with each other. And yeah, so I think there's a really good example of experiencing this many worlds as the multiverse, and this fact that the quantum level of reality is occurring at all levels of reality.
Oh, okay. Do we have a caller on the line, Carlos? Oh, okay. Well, put him on the line. I think it's Mike, right? Hi, Mike.
I'm here. How are you?
I'm fine. Cynthia, can you hear our caller?
It's kind of quiet, but I can sort of hear him.
Okay. You ought to speak up just a bit.
All right.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. You're totally clipping.
I was calling, but I remember from my school teacher, bears.
I'm sorry, Mike. I can barely hear you. You're clipping in and out. I think maybe the gain's too high at the studio level. Say again. Nah, we lost him. I'm sorry about that. Cynthia, sometimes technology works and sometimes it doesn't. It seems that conscious technology might be more reliable. So how do we decide? I mean, if we're able to bring other people with us, remember what I asked before about soul groups?
Right.
Do a group of us go from universe to universe kind of to share different experiences?
That makes sense, doesn't it? Because, I mean, when you think about the interrelationships and the connections that we have and what we're entangled with and the synchronicities that we experience, then absolutely, you know, it makes sense that there's a feeling of community, that some of us do want to experience the same, you know, we find the same things interesting, we're intrigued by similar things, and so I think it's really true that we're creating them together. Even though it may not seem obvious because we're looking at our conscious minds, but quite a bit of who we are and our overall consciousness is operating on a subconscious level.
If we go back to that survey, you noted, and you made actual note of it, that there appear to be changes over time. What do you attribute the changes to? Because I know what I would think, but I don't have enough data. So what do you think is going on?
Right. One thing I've noticed, and you're talking about the two different surveys, one conducted in the year 2000, one in 2013, some of the more substantial differences occurred with, for example, seeing people and animals heal after prayer. Oh, it looks like we got another call coming in.
I believe it's John. John, are you there?
Hi, Richard. Hi, Cynthia. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you fine. Cynthia?
Good.
I can hear you. Kind of quiet, but I can sort of hear you. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm driving a truck on the Bluetooth. I was just hoping you could hear me okay. I've had those experiences all my life. They happen more frequently once you start noticing them. And I believe that the Mandela effect, the virtual reality theory of everything, and the torsion field physics all tie in together.
Okay, I think I tend to agree with you.
Yeah, well, like Nassim Haramein said on your show, atoms are basically little torsion fields. They're drawing in this zero-point energy, or a better, you know, term may be the ether, or the best term I've heard is consciousness units. That goes back to the virtual reality is running in the mind of the creator. The consciousness units are conscious or intelligent.
John, did I lose you?
Hello, can you hear me, Richard?
Yeah, I can hear you, yeah. You said you had a couple of experiences. You want to tell us about one?
Oh, yeah, real quickly. I know it's almost the end of the show. The first one I really noticed was when Reagan got shot. I experienced it with some friends hearing it on the radio that he was assassinated. We were all shocked. We talked about it that day, talked to other people. The next day I turn on the news, they're talking about how well he did on the hospital, and he was doing okay, and I was just shocked. I asked my wife if what was going on. She said, why? They said yesterday. You know, she was with me when we heard it on the radio, and we all discussed it, and none of the other people remembered what I remembered. And that just, I considered it a time slip.
Huh. Cynthia?
That's an interesting example, and it's amazing when you hear something like that. Then a lot of people, after hearing the reversal of the news, something being downgraded from an assassination to recovery in a hospital, might assume that they misheard it, or they might doubt the news service. But I presume that you followed up, and there was no misstatement. And that's something news media would not make a mistake about something like that. I personally
if one news agency made a mistake, others would correct it soon.
Right.
It wouldn't be left as the general impression. So you and your wife made the trek.
Yes, and there were several other people there with us that day, and none of them remembered what I remembered, yet we all talked about it. That's why I just didn't think it was in my own, you know, a flaw in my memory or some delusion on my part, because I clearly remembered other people involved. You know, it was a heated conversation about what that was going to mean for everybody and everything. And then the next day, nobody but me remembered that being that way. It was pretty bizarre. I've noticed over time, once you start noticing, that was the biggest one. It could be very small things just involving you and another person, something you distinctly remember happening, and a month later, they have no knowledge of it. Or, you know, it could be on any scale. It's amazing. I have always called them time slips. I've thought about this stuff for years.
Well, thank you so much for calling. We don't have a lot of time, and I want Cynthia to talk about her cruise. So thanks again.
Thank you, Richard. Bye, Cynthia.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Okay, let's talk about the cruise, because I love cruises. Where are you going to be? Where are you cruising? And obviously you're going to talk about this, right?
Right. Well, this is a cruise into Spirit, and it's coming up. It'll be happening going from Fort Lauderdale to the Eastern Caribbean, and it's on the cruise ship Oasis of the Seas, which is Royal Caribbean. And it's basically a seminar at sea, so it does involve a nightly UFO watch. It has yoga, all kinds of good food. It's 7 days on the cruise. And there will be lots of presentations, talks, and events on board, as well as some things that are being scheduled in each port of call. So it's something that where you can sign up. And if you mention my name, then that really helps, because it shows that there are people interested in this whole topic, mm-hmm. as well as coming along with me. And the website is cruiseintospirit.com, and you can sign up there. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. So
it looks amazing. And yeah, you're going to get a lot of people telling you their experiences, and you're going to kind of order their experiences in terms of what they might have missed.
Right. I like to help people go from being accidental manifestors into being able to bring it all together and recognize that what you focus on more of, you get more of. So it's a process of bringing your subconscious on board with your conscious and lining up all those aspects of yourself.
Well, if people want to know more about the Cruise into Spirit, go to link number 5 under Cynthia's items tonight on Radio with Pictures on the Other Side of Midnight homepage. Hey, we've only got maybe 30 seconds left. Thank you so much, Cynthia. This is, to me, this is kind of like we've got to keep pursuing this, because there may be events that an awful lot of people will share up ahead that will bring it to mainstream consciousness.
That's right. And it's a way to practically improve our lives as well.
Well, we didn't get into the whole thing of how we can use this to consciously change a reality that you don't like to maybe move to one that you do like. That'll be our next conversation. We'll do a kind of a how to bring this down so people can use it to make their own lives better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's one of my favorite topics.
Well, that's the end of our show. Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Thank you.
And we shall see everyone tomorrow morning. We have an incredible surprise tomorrow morning. We're going to be talking to the principal investigator of the Dawn Mission to 67P. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.